a replay of this hour, go to episodes at tntradio.live. Now, TNT Radio News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed that Israel would fight alone if necessary, responding to President Joe Biden's warning that the U.S. would halt the supply of certain weapons if Israeli forces target densely populated areas in Rafah, Gaza. Netanyahu's remarks came after the Biden administration delayed a shipment of high-payload munitions to Israel, reflecting U.S. concerns about potential civilian casualties in Gaza. Despite the U.S. stance, Netanyahu asserted Israel's readiness to proceed independently in its military campaign to eliminate Hamas from Rafah. The U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin acknowledged the delay in munitions delivery and emphasized the importance of precision in military operations to minimize collateral damage.
If you want to avoid civilian casualties, you need these weapons rather than imprecise weaponry. But I think beyond that, look, I've known Joe Biden for many years, so 40 years and more. We often had our agreements, but we've had our disagreements. We've been able to overcome them. I hope we can overcome them now, but we will do what we have to do to protect our country, and that means protect our future.
During a series of pro-Palestinian protests in New York City, communist organizations distributed pamphlets advocating for a physical revolution and escalation of conflict. A meeting at Revolution Books in Harlem featured discussions about gathering forces for revolution, with Carl Dix of the Revolutionary Communist Party emphasizing the need for revolutionary change. Groups like the Revolutionary Internationalist Youth and the Internationalist Group were actively involved in protests at several universities and advocated for linking current struggles to an international socialist revolution. These groups distributed materials promoting a binational Arab-Hebrew-Palestinian worker state and a socialist federation of the Middle East. Marxist literature, like the Workers' Vanguard, called for a national student strike to free Palestine and escalate societal struggles, particularly within the labor movement. Additionally, the NYPD has reported evidence of groups radicalizing students and organizing protests. New York Mayor Eric Adams highlighted concerns about external actors influencing protests to create chaos rather than peacefully protest, underscoring the global issue of radicalization among youth. An international watchdog, UN Watch, has accused staff at the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine refugees of misappropriating humanitarian aid intended for Gaza residents and selling it for profit. The allegations, which include reports from whistleblowers within the agency, suggest a pattern of theft and resale of items such as food and baby diapers by UNRWA staff. These whistleblowers, who have voiced their concerns in online chat rooms created by a former UNRWA employee, also report facing repercussions for the disclosures. The UNRWA, aware of the report, is currently investigating these claims. This controversy adds to the previous allegations against some UNRWA staff members who have been accused of involvement in a violent attack by Hamas on October 7, 2023, which resulted in significant Israeli casualties. This connection has led to further scrutiny of UNRWA's operations and its alleged ties to Hamas, which the U.S. State Department has designated as a terrorist organization. The issue raises significant concerns about UNRWA's role and effectiveness in providing aid and its implications for peace efforts in the region. Fox News contributor Mark Thiessen explained how former President Trump's court battles are impacting the 2024 presidential election.
I'm enormously, man. I feel very badly for President Trump that he has to go through this. But politically, it's political gold for him. First of all, it's creating sympathy for him. I mean, he's facing 91 charges at the federal, state, and local level. Charles Manson faced 10. Our polls show that people think this is unfair.
We'll be back with another news break at the top of the next hour. This has been James O'Neill for TNT.
This is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio. All right, ladies and gentlemen. All right, welcome to the program. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. We'll be live and direct for the next 2 hours here on TNT, Today's News Talk. Pleasure to have you joining us this week, all week. It's been an eventful week. We've had some powerful segments, some great reports, and some incredible analysis. We aim to give that to you every day, and I think we've been delivering on that. That's why our numbers are growing. That's why the audience is growing. I'm getting great feedback as well. Hello to everybody in the TNT chat community. Great to see you guys in there piling in for the next 2 hours. That's where the action is during the show. Just go to tntradio.live, Redbubble, lower right-hand corner. Click in, log on, stay logged in for the whole week. That's where you want to be. So we have a great community that's formed in the TNT chat room. Also, our community on X around this show is also growing. I want to say hello to everybody there as well who are joining us via that platform. We're also live streaming that right now on my @21wire Twitter feed. You can also go to TNT Radio's Twitter feed as well, or X Twitter, as it's called. Great job with the rebranding, Elon. Everybody has to qualify it with X, formerly known as Twitter. So anyway, we can criticize that later. I want to welcome onto the stage in a couple of minutes. I'm very privileged to be able to speak to a great historian and a great political analyst, Mats Nilsson from Stockholm, Sweden. He's going to join us to talk about the legacy of Victory Day, May 9th. This is a major day. Certainly, if you're in Eastern Europe or Russia, this is sort of the defining national holiday, really, on the calendar each year. Russia is a good example of this. It is probably the most important date on the political calendar in terms of pageantry and ceremony. This is really an annual thing that people take very seriously and take it to heart. I've also been recently in Eastern Europe and Belarus as well. This is also an important day in that country for the incredible suffering that these people went through and the losses they had to incur to bring the Third Reich to its knees. And don't forget, it is Russia who inflicted the most casualties on the Nazi war machine. The Red Army did that. 70% of all Nazi casualties were inflicted by the Red Army, so they actually defeated Germany, not the U.S. The coalition did some things, but in terms of breaking the back of that and changing the course of history, it definitely Russia, the Red Army, the Soviet Union that did the heavy lifting there. That's recognized during the Victory Day celebrations. We'll talk to Mats about the legacy of this and also about how it's casting a shadow into the 21st century and how dangerous the situation we're all facing right now with the NATO proxy war in Ukraine against Russia. The risks, and looking back with a little bit of historical perspective on that, I think is also very important. Now, as well, in the second hour, we're going to be joined by a great political commentator, Benjamin Rubenstein, who's going to be joining us on the live link to discuss. Ben's put out a new video recently, which I found to be absolutely fascinating and a really compelling analysis. And we're calling it America's Lost Colony. Use your imagination to guess who we're talking about. We'll break that down with Benjamin Rubenstein in the second hour. He's doing great work on social media with his various video vignettes. Look forward to catching up with Ben there as well. Now, in terms of major news, I think we're going to have to go to really the big story of the day, and that has to be the vote in the United Nations General Assembly today. There was a vote on whether to recognize Palestine, or more specifically, the Palestinian Authority, as a member of the United Nations. Very controversial, of course, and there's some countries that, well, let's just say they weren't very happy about this, and they weren't going to support this in any way. So who is the axis, of democracy opposing Palestine being recognized by the United Nations General Assembly? Well, of course, it's led by the United States, and isn't that interesting? When we listen to Tony Blinken and all these various diplomats, even Joe Biden has murmured the two-state solution here and there. They all use it. They give it lip service. But do they really mean it? Well, apparently not. United States votes no in the UN General Assembly, no recognition of Palestine at all. Of course, Israel's completely against it. They did their theatrics. We'll show some of those theatrics. We have a video of one of those, which we'll share with you probably in the second hour. But and then let's look at the rest of these esteemed list here. Argentina and Javier Milei, or Milei, as I like to call him, the so-called libertarian president of Argentina. Of course, they voted no. Hungary, no surprise, staunch supporter of Israel there. Czech Republic in the pocket of the West on all things, NATO included. Papua New Guinea, a powerhouse in the U.S. coalition there. And of course, you can't put a coalition together without Micronesia. Micronesia also voting no, shoulder to shoulder with Washington on this this issue. And Nauru, you're going to have to Google that one. Palau, this is another archipelago there. And that forms the axis of democracy and goodness and justice with the United States. It's a powerful coalition. Okay, let's not kid ourselves. This is a force to be reckoned with, this new axis of democracy. They oppose any recognition of a Palestinian state. So that's all the U.S. could and Israel could scare up. That's all they could scare up for their sort of alliance against recognizing Palestine. Curiously, the British abstained. They don't want to be caught saying no or yes. So they very cleverly have hedged their position there, nested under the wing of the great American eagle. Britain says, abstain. And a couple of other European countries doing the same, not wanting to be in the crosshairs of the Israeli lobby, but then not wanting to completely lose support of the youth in their country. So they do the clever thing, which is to do nothing. Strategic abstaining of the vote on this issue. Not surprised, quite frankly, not surprised. No surprise here. But anyway, that's in the news. General Assembly, this has been vetoed at the UN Security Council level, of course. GA vote cannot be vetoed. However, there's a lot of minutia in here. This is not exactly what it appears on the surface. There are a whole bunch of other caveats to this that may in fact circle back to the UN Security Council. And the important designation here, ladies and gentlemen, and pay close attention, is that can a country that is engaged as a co-belligerent in a conflict or a genocide or something like this, go in and use their veto power either on the UN Security Council or even vote against a resolution like this in the GA, the General Assembly? And that's a question because the United States is being dragged into this frame. The U.S. is being dragged into this frame. And so they have a lot to answer for in this regard. So the U.S. can't claim to be a neutral party. I've said this many times. They can't claim to be kind of, you know, remote and not directly involved in the conflict. Make no mistake about it. The United States are as at war with the Palestinian population than the state of Israel are. Because quite frankly and simply, the state of Israel could not prosecute this slaughter that we're watching unfold over 7 months without the full expressed support of the United States of America, materially, politically, and every other level of support. The U.S. has given him everything. Joe Biden's given him everything. And the fact that he's been making noise this past week about slowing up arms shipments to Israel, there's a lot of different ways that you can interpret that. Of course, we'll probably do a breakdown of that on Sunday, on the Sunday Wire. If you tune in here on X at 21st Century Wire, but I'll give you just kind of a preview of that analysis. Basically, U.S. is hemorrhaging support internationally because of their unflagging loyalty to Israel. That's number one. But during an election year, the Democrats are losing a huge swath of the Gen Z vote. They love to appeal to the youth, love to be hip, but they're not hip anymore. There's a lot of the great influencers, the political vanguard of the young generation are not going to vote Democrat on the basis of this issue of the genocide in Gaza. So where are they going to do? They'll sit it out. They'll do a protest vote for Jill Stein. Who knows? But they ain't voting for Biden. That's for sure. So could this be pressuring Biden to slow up armaments and munitions deliveries to Israel? Or could it be option number three, And option number three is the United States. It's not that they don't want to give them. It's they don't have them. They've run out. The stocks are low. We talked about this with Larry Johnson on Wednesday. The stocks are low. Between Ukraine, all their commitments globally, the 1,000 bases around the world, all their partners that they're shipping arms to in Europe, and Ukraine, and Israel, the stockades are running low. Don't say it too loud, though, because Russia might take advantage of this very weak moment in U.S. military history. I'm just saying, I'm just throwing that out there for food for thought, food for thought. Right now, let's take a break with the network TNT. And when we come back, we'll connect with our great guest, historian and political analyst Mats Nilsson, on the other side. All this and more coming up. Stay with us, folks. We'll be right back.
TNT's James Freeman.
Nelson Mandela said to be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others. The truth is, too many people have taken their eyes off the ball over the past 50 years. Too many good people have lived in the hope that electing members of parliament to take care of things for us every 5 years will keep things on the straight and narrow. The result of this is that we have allowed too much power to be concentrated in the hands of too few.
James Freeman on today's News Talk TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission. So many people who had no history of heart illnesses have got it now, or blood clotting after the COVID-19 vaccination. Punish those who hurt people with COVID madness, lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the program. We're still in hour number one of this live broadcast. We're going to try to connect our guest, Mats Nilsson, having some connection issues across the Atlantic Ocean. We'll try to iron those out. In the meantime, we're going to go back to sort of analyzing some of the main stories as well while we wait for our first guest, Mats Nilsson, to arrive on stage. And back to the subject of Victory Day, of course, this was the conversation that we're going to have with historian Mats Nilsson from Stockholm, Sweden. It's a very important day for Russia. And they did something very interesting this year. They filled up Red Square with some trophies from the Donbass, mainly United States Abrams tanks, British Challengers, Leopard tanks from Germany, French tanks, all the things that they captured on the battlefield, the kind of parading them and showing like NATO weaponry. So NATO says they're not at war with Russia, but Russia has a full stock of NATO weapons on display in Red Square during the Victory Day celebrations. So figure that one out. What an embarrassment for NATO. This is one of the reasons why the United States is reticent to send any of the new kit, any of the new equipment into Ukraine. If they send their top-of-the-line Abrams tanks, for instance, and then, you know, a whole bunch of these end up on display in Red Square. Not before, of course, they're being studied by Russian military engineers to reverse engineer all the systems in these advanced weapons coming from the U.S. and their allies. But anyway, besides the fact it's just embarrassing, it's a tactical nightmare. The same goes for pretty much anything that you put live in the field. And this is one of the things that I think some of the war planners at NATO Central don't really like to think through. They don't really think. They just think, well, if we just give them weapons, those brave Ukrainians are going to steamroll over those Russians, and we can all sort of clink our champagne glasses and laugh all the way to our next dividend check from one of the big military industrial providers like Lockheed Martin or BAE Systems or whatever. They don't really think it through. And this is one of the reasons why, again, Ukraine can't win anyway. They can't even get advanced weapons, not anything significant or serious, in their own hands. And even if they did, let's be honest, at this point in this war of attrition, the amount of people they've lost, the fact that they're having to impress young men off the street, literally kidnapping people and throwing them onto the front line. The fact they have to do all that, even if they had the most advanced weapons at their disposal, it's doubtful that it's going to make any meaningful impact militarily against a superpower like the Russian Federation. I mean, these people are just fooling themselves, and they've been fooling themselves for about 2 years. Of course, let's not forget that the big tragedy in all this is the Ukrainian people themselves. The losses they've incurred have been historic. And it's really sad that people in the West don't really care that much about that number. They're totally disinterested. If you start to bring this topic up, all you get are blank stares, cognitive dissonance. Nobody wants to acknowledge the real numbers. What are the real numbers? By anyone's guesstimation, at the rate, I mean, we're talking about 370,000 dead young men and old men, Ukrainians, just a few months ago. All these theaters have been live since then. We're well over 400,000. I mean, the estimations coming from the Russian MOD side are apocalyptic, talking about 500,000, half a million men. For what? For what? No chance of victory. There never was a chance of victory, so that's a waste of a half a million men from the country that is now suffering chronic labor shortages and will probably be enforced to import labor at some point in the near future. Imagine that, reverse immigration into Ukraine. What a disaster. Can we call it a success? It's been a disaster on every single conceivable level, yet they're still pumping billions of dollars into this project. They believe, U.S. lawmakers believe, they can weaken the Russians if we just send a few more secondhand F-16s to Zelensky, along with, I don't know, a few howitzers, some attackums, some of these HIMARS rockets. They think that's going to turn the tide. It's not. It's not. They're losing land. They're losing position every day. And at the current rate, Russia will most likely be able to capture enclaves like Odessa, nominally Russian, and Kharkiv in the northeast, nominally Russian, and who knows what else, all the way to the Dnieper River, and then the country is basically split in two. It's partitioned. And so you have East Ukraine and you have West Ukraine. All the GDP of this country is in the east of the Ukraine. The resources are in the east, not much in the west. So the West can keep the west of Ukraine. Russia will keep the east. And they'll call it a day. Or will they? Or will they? It all depends. It all depends. I think Odessa will be, to me, the big sort of watershed. Because if Odessa falls into the hands of the Russian Federation, then that's bye-bye for your coastline for Ukraine. They become landlocked at that point. And they become a rump state, literally a rump state in the middle of Europe with no coastline, not much in terms of resources, not much in terms of prospects. And they're not going to be militarized or a NATO member. Russia won't allow it at that point. It's not going to happen. So what have they got to play for here? They don't really have much to play for, but I'll tell you something. Looking at the announcements over the last week that the people who have been pouring money into this project in Ukraine, we're talking about the Black Rocks of the world, the big investment funds, the masters of the universe, the masters of the universe in the West. They want a return on their investment. They're already talking about restructuring the debt of Ukraine. Remember, Trump made an announcement a couple of weeks ago that he wants to, you know, keep the tap open for the life support system for Ukraine, but want to restructure these into loans. Loans, so more debt. So expecting to pay it back. Of course, Ukraine's not going to pay anything back. That's not what this game is about. It's not about paying back the money that you poured into the project. the name of the game is pouring money or loans or finance onto Ukraine and then negotiating what you're going to take as collateral or payment, because they ain't going to be cash. Ukraine's never going to pay back the cash. But what they can do is foreclose. And they can foreclose on land, agricultural land, water resources, minerals, natural gas, whatever's left, it'll get plundered. It'll get plundered by the same interests that helped to gin up this conflict in the first place. Now you can see how the game really works. This is the business George Soros is also in. This is called vulture capitalism. Quite clearly and succinctly, this is how it's done. And this is not the first time. But this is the most egregious of all operations like this, because they had to bait a world superpower in order to get involved in this ungodly project and risk World War III, risk a thermonuclear exchange. This is exactly what we've seen in the last 10 days. Massive escalation by NATO, war of the words, provocations, commitments to put troops on the ground, Russia responding in kind, announcing tactical nuclear weapons drills. So we say to, as I tweeted to Jan Stoltenberg during the week, are you happy yet? Are you satisfied yet? We're at the precipice of a nuclear confrontation with the world's biggest, in terms of deployable nuclear, advanced nuclear weapons. Russia is number one. U.S. is number two. Do you want to poke that bear in the way that they have and risk a potential nuclear exchange, even if it's a tactical nuclear exchange? We're talking about tactical nukes. We're talking about low-yield nuclear weapons. But low yield doesn't mean no yield. Today's, put it in perspective for you, today's low yield nuclear weapons, what they call tactical nukes, these are the equivalent of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Still does a lot of damage. You can still take out and flatten a whole city. That's a tactical nuke by today's standards. Strategic nuclear weapons, much more powerful in terms of total kilotons, and then you have the radiation fallout and all of the damage commensurate with that type of weapon of mass destruction. Do we really want to get involved in wargaming this out? They've already wargamed it. We spent decades during the Cold War wargaming all of this stuff out. But do we have to do it again? What's the point? Mutually assured destruction. That was the name of the doctrine. That was the name of the doctrine. But now we're seeing this sort of caveat to this policy. We're seeing the caveat to this policy now come to fruition. And it's sad. It's incredibly sad. Let's take a break right now with the network TNT. When we come back, we'll try to connect our guest in Europe. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. Stay with us.
When I had my heart event close to 4 years ago, I was at the gym, thought I deserve a coffee, and thought I'll top up with fuel, ordered a coffee. But while I was pumping fuel, I started to get chest pains. Then it got worse and worse and worse. So then I was leaning on the counter thinking, yeah, something's not quite right. So then I went to wait for the coffee, and that's when it really, really hit. And Joy just, you know, mouthed, do you need an ambulance? And I remember nodding. I wasn't even thinking about a heart attack. I just thought, something is seriously wrong with me here. So when the cardiologist came to see me, she informed me that I'd had what they call a widowmaker heart attack. Bit of a shock when someone says, you know, you nearly died. Everybody should be aware of all the symptoms of a heart attack that women can have that aren't typical of the shoulder pain, the right arm pain. I go to the gym, I do yoga, Pilates, I swim, I go on bike rides, and yet I still had a heart attack. You just don't know, it could be you.
What do I love about riding? It's the thrill, the excitement. Riding gives me a sense of freedom. I feel so connected to the road. Riding is like therapy to me. makes me feel alive. Love riding? Back off.
You ever heard of a polyp? Sounds like a rare species of toad. Actually, it's a lump that grows inside me, your bowel. Look, I'm pretty sure if you had a strange lump growing on your forehead, you might get it looked at, right? But when they're growing inside me, nothing, nada. And the polyps I get can lead to Australia's second deadliest cancer. So, until there's a way to make them grow on your face, it's up to you to get me looked at. Got it?
Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
All right, folks, welcome back. We're in hour number one of this live broadcast, live and direct here on TNT Radio.live. Great to have you guys with us. Great to see the numbers building up in the TNT chat community. You can just go to TNTRadio.live and look in the lower right-hand corner. There's a red bubble. Just click on that. That'll get you into the chat room. That's where we want to be during the broadcast. A lot of great information, a lot of fun happening there during the program. A lot of you guys like being in there. You love the banter. You love the camaraderie, and we love you, our audience. Now, I want to welcome on to the stage a very special guest is joining us from the heart of Europe, Scandinavia to be more precise. Mats Nilsson is a historian, also a political commentator. He's joining us right now from Europe. It's late where you are, Mats, and we appreciate you joining us. The big news right now in Eastern Europe anyway, one of the big events on the calendar is Victory Day, May 9th, and the scenes in Red Square. Yes. It's a very important day in Russia. A lot of Eastern European countries, not celebrated in exactly the same way in the West. It doesn't have the same gravitas, this event on the calendar, Mats. And I think you'll agree with me that World War II is viewed through a very different lens depending on what part of Europe you're from. And I think this is a big disconnect, and maybe this is a source of a lot of misunderstanding and miscommunication, especially between the West and Russia. But I want to get your thoughts on Victory Day as a retrospective and how it relates to us today.
I think this is where history and propaganda meet, so to speak. We can even see that on the fact that there is a disconnect between what day Victory Day is celebrated. I remember, for example, in Sweden on, I think it was May the 6th, celebrations broke out, peace celebrations broke out. My grandfather told me, because he took part in the peace celebration at Kungsgatan in Stockholm. He went out into the streets and started celebrating Victory Day. Well, one day ahead of May 7th or May 8th, which was later perceived as the Western European Victory Day in Europe. And then later, of course, May 9th as the VE Day in the Soviet Union, and then later Russia, became the day for celebrating victory over the fascist Germany. And of course, it's we have to remember this was just Victory Day in Europe. The god awful war continued on for another few months until America felt the need it needed to prove itself and drop the two atomic bombs on Japan. And we can have a discussion about if that was necessary or not. We'll just leave that and stick to Victory in Europe Day. But it's for all intents and purposes, as soon as the guns hadn't even stopped shooting before certain generals within the Western allies started speaking about going on towards the Soviet Union and quickly attacking the Soviet Union, I think quite a few of us have read about General George S. Patton being quite adamant about, now is the time to strike against the Soviet Union while they are still weak from having defeated fascist Germany, when he inadvertently admitted that the defeat of fascist Germany
was, for all intents and purposes, born on the shoulders of the Soviet soldiers, be they Ukrainian, Belarusian, Kazakhi, or Russian soldiers marching towards Berlin. Of course, the Western and especially the American aid to the Soviet Union had a lot of impact on the victory. But suffice to say, it was the Russian and the Soviet soldiers who did the bleeding and was aided by the equipment that they received. So I would say it's politics. And in Russia today, of course, Victory Day has been enhanced. I would be lying if I am not saying that Victory Day on May 9th is now also used as propaganda for the Russian leaders. Propaganda is everywhere, I think, but we in the West have to admit to ourselves that we use propaganda just as much as anyone else. And as for May 9th, it's a perfect opportunity for Russia today to remind the world of the sacrifices that the Soviet Union and, in a large part, Russia made in defeating Germany, which of course is met by silence in the West, because the West doesn't really want to remind the world that Russia and the Soviet Union bore the brunt of the massacres in civilians and soldiers during World War II. I think Belarus was the country that suffered the most percentage of civilians killed during the Second World War. But that's, of course, nothing you want to discuss and nothing that you want to highlight in Western Europe. I don't think there was any Swedish mainstream newspaper who had any article relating to the sacrifices of the Soviet Union on May 9th. It was just met with quiet. It's sad, really, because this would be an opportunity to seek common ground. But instead, the differences are enhanced. And we're stuck, as we always are, with the East and the West and animosities building and the war in Ukraine continuing as always.
I think what's interesting about this conversation, Mats, and you may or may not agree with me, depending, because I know people have very different attitudes depending on what part of Europe you're in terms of your relations with, let's say, Russia, for instance. But the Russians do acknowledge that they were allied with the U.S., with the Allied forces, and they, you know, they do view it as a, you know, collaborative effort to defeat Germany and defeat the Axis powers during the Second World War, but they also are, you know, cognizant of the sacrifice that they had to make. It really speaks to the they use this as a reminder of their resilience and their determination as a nation. And that's so May 9th is really important on the calendar in Russia for that reason. And it kind of, you know, it reflects forward in history with what they're currently undergoing right now with the Donbass and with Ukraine and NATO and so forth. They want to reiterate this. They want to reinforce this idea in the present day. And I can understand the sacrifices made in terms of the sheer numbers of losses on the Russian side. I don't know what the numbers are, but civilians and combat totaling somewhere around 25 million plus. So when you're talking about numbers like that, that does echo and reverberate forward in history. And it's very difficult to sort of, you know, write that one off, say, oh yeah, that was a long time ago, because everybody is affected in some deep and profound way by that. So I see this as, it just takes on a whole nother level of gravity for Russia. And this is why I think this holiday is still very important. What do you think about that? Do you think they still feel there's a chance that fighting could break out again, given certain circumstances in Europe?
Of course, Russia believes this, and I think it. One thing that struck me was that a lot of Western media, including some Swedish media, were making fun of the fact that the only tank that drove across the Red Square during the military parade was the T-34. Now, that speaks, as you said, that speaks volumes about how certain Western journalists and Western commentators fail to realize the significance of this war for the Russian people and the Russian understanding of themselves and how they identify themselves. This single T-34 tank told everyone within the Russian sphere of influence or within the Russian community globally that Russia will not be defeated now as they weren't defeated then, because they will start making new T-34s or whatever the iconic tank of the current day and age is, because the T-34 is a symbol and was a symbol for the fact that Russia didn't give in. No matter what the cost, the motherland was always going to be defended. And you have to remember that the motherland during World War II shedded most of its communist layers, because what Stalin did quite early on during the Second World War, when Russia and the Soviet Union was attacked, he said, you can once again start using the imagery of the former Russian republics. You can once again start to talk about Nevsky. You can once again start talking about Peter the Great. You can once again start talking about Suvorov and the generals that defeated Napoleon and generals that defeated the Turks, and so on and so forth. Meaning that once Mother Russia is threatened, the ideologies just disappears. Mm. And once again, no matter how much, I think almost no matter how much Western liberals hated Putin before this war in Ukraine escalated, now they will have moved to stand behind the idea of once again protecting the motherland. So the West has unified Russia. As we've spoken about before, with the sanctions, with the war of aggression, with all the military supplies that are handed to Ukraine, they've basically served Russia a silver platter of unification and of newfound strength. It's May 9th will always reverberate in history, in the history books of Russia. And there are still people alive today who fought in that war, as we saw on the podium. And these people are still icons within the Russian community. And there is nothing the West can do to try and bring down the feeling of pride within within Russia for the sacrifices made. And trying to make fun of it, you know, by calling it, oh, just one tank, that's all Russia have, and so forth and so on, it's just going to further solidify the Russian people against the West, or at least for as so long they feel the need to fight off a Western perceived aggression. It's perfect propaganda, and once again the West is failing to understand Russia and the idea that has built Russia through the centuries.
Yeah, that is you make a really important point, Mats, is that in the new iteration of the Russian Federation, they can invoke the old great war heroes in the Russian Empire in history, whereas during Soviet times, that frame was much more limited because of ideology and politics. So this does reinvigorate the idea of Mother Russia in a much bigger timeline. I think that's really important. I had quite a profound experience, Matt, recently when I had an opportunity to have some historical and also cultural experiences in learning about Belarus when I went to Minsk recently. And I had no idea of the role that that country played in the Second World War of, well, eventually breaking the back of the Nazi army as it was occupying that country for almost 3 years. But the partisan rebellions in the notorious forests, thick wooded areas of Belarus, became very difficult for the Nazis, occupying Nazis, to manage. They had 2,000 internment camps Germany was running at any point in time during the course of that occupation. And I believe their losses, Matt, including everybody in camps and otherwise, 2.3 million in around a 3 year period. I mean, just think of the for a small country like this. I mean, it's just unspeakable. But it's hardly a footnote in the conversation of World War II, unless you've studied it or seen the films. Many iconic films have been made about the partisans in Belarus and so forth, and the rebellion against the Nazi occupation. But you know, outside of a very, I think, very small, narrow portal, there's not much in the conversation there. And I find that to be extraordinary, because you can't understand the people in this part of the world without understanding their story. And this is a big part of their national story. And hence they spend a lot of time and energy in, you know, presenting this story. I went to a village, infamous village called Hatyn, I think I pronounced that correctly, where the people in the village were put into a barn and burned alive by the Germans. And that the area has been preserved. There's no buildings left. There's just monuments there. But people make that pilgrimage, and schools and so forth. It's part of the educational experience in Belarus. But again, Matt, I never really heard that story in all my years. It's just extraordinary. But your thoughts?
Well, for me, as a Swede, we've always been quite, or from since you're young, when you're taught in school about the Vikings going and, for all intents and purposes, establishing the Belarusian and Rus, or establishing the Rus Empire, which back then included current Ukraine, Kiev, and Belarus. And the Vikings and the Swedish kings were intermarried with the nobility of these this areas since the 8th or 9th century onward, up until around 1200, when the Golden Horde started to move in and occupy these parts. So we've always been aware that there have been a Belarus. And as for Belarusians, their identity, it's of course been difficult for them to break free from Russia, seen as what they gave to defeating the German armies during World War II. But I think if I've been to Belarus, both Belarus, Russia and Ukraine, I've been there, and as I've told you before, I lived in Russia during the 1990s. And I think Belarusia has a sense of pride for what they did. I mean, in the swamps and in the forests, and the partisans of Belarus, there have been so many movies made about these partisans giving, essentially forcing the Germans to deviate large amounts of support troops to guarding not the trade routes, the supply routes towards the front lines. And as they did so, they had ample opportunity to take out lots and lots of German material and lots of German soldiers. And they were recognized for this and for their fight against Nazism. And today, of course, they're in the shadows somewhat of Russia proper today. But I think the Belarusian people most have a firm understanding and pride in what they contributed with in defeating the Nazis. And also, as we've seen, there have been clips on Telegram, the Telegram channels, concerning old people in Ukraine with a Soviet background who were directly involved in the Second World War, or who were children of people who were affected by the Second World War, trying to celebrate May 9th in Ukraine. As you know now, May 9th in Ukraine is now Europe Day, as it is, in the rest of Western Europe. May 9th is Europe Day. And of course, there were European Union flags in Ukraine. Meanwhile, these few remaining veterans and these few remaining older people who have a direct linkage to the Second World War were shoved off the streets and the places of memory in Ukraine. And also, I think there were a few memorial services that were supposed to be held in certain Russian Orthodox churches in Ukraine that was also forcibly closed, saying that this was not something concerning the fight against fascism and Nazism. It was a pro-Russian manifestation. And once again, it only goes to prove that history is always partly propaganda. And Ukraine, of course, is desperate as not to be reminded about the fascist past. And suddenly you're having discussions about Bandera and the Western Ukrainian support for Nazi Germany. And that's a discussion that Zelensky, of course, doesn't need right now, especially since what many commentators are saying, Russia has initiated a thrust towards Kharkiv in Ukraine just the recent 24 hours. So right now, I think there's a lot of discussion with mild to severe panic going on in Kyiv. But they're still playing. They're still playing their part. When Mrs. Metsola was in Kyiv today, of course, they were having a speech out in the open, and there was an air raid siren. Always an air raid siren when the dignitaries come, and you have to, the camera has to make some shaky movement when they're rushing towards the shelter. But it's of course Russia doesn't want to kill Zelensky. Russia believes that Zelensky is the worst, best leader that Ukraine can have from a Russian perspective. I don't think anyone, I think actually if Kyiv was to learn that someone was plotting to kill Zelensky, I think the Kremlin would probably help save Zelensky just to keep him there, to keep him in power, because he's a godsend gift to the Russians, the way he's handling things, or not handling things as it is right now. It's I just feel sorry for him a bit, because I sadly believe he might not get through this alive in the coming months ahead. And it's not that I particularly love Zelensky, but he's still a human being, and I don't want to see him go the same way Ceausescu did. I wish he gets an escape somehow, but that's a whole different discussion.
Yeah, well, you're right, Matt. The last thing Russia would want to do is interrupt Zelensky and this slow, glorious train wreck that he is currently commandeering, and makes their job kind of easier on the public relations battle as well. So yeah, very aptly put there. And I agree with you. I'm on your side on that in terms of Zelensky. He is a tragic figure, Matt, in the historical sense, unparalleled actually in modern times. And this Faustian tale will eventually come to an end. and then we'll become part of history at that point. But it's fascinating. Mats Nilsson, historian, political commentator based in Sweden. Thank you for joining us on TNT this week. Much appreciated.
Thank you very much.
Great historical perspective from Mats Nilsson, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll be sharing that clip on our X feed tomorrow as well. Listen, top of the hour news headlines coming up right now. We're going to connect on the other side with the great Benjamin Rubenstein to get an inside scoop on this question, America's lost colony. Where is it? Who is it? You know what I'm talking about. All that and more coming up. Stay with us.